Welcome to this special encore performance of Veterans Radio. Happy 4th of July. This week we're going to be replaying our program from July 3rd, 2010. So please join our host Gary Lilly and his guest Peter Fletcher.
All across America and around the world, welcome to America's number one veterans program, Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host for today's program, former CB Chulai 1966 Republic of Vietnam, Gary Lilly.
And thank you very much, Bob. What a pleasure to be here on the day before our Independence Day. And I'll have we'll have a wonderful guest, Peter Fletcher, who is so entertaining and is so knowledgeable about all things America. Everything. He knows everything. But right now, I just would like to say good morning and thank you to all of our troops that are serving this country overseas and in here in this country, that thin green and blue line that keeps and preserves the freedom of not just our country, but many other countries around the world. And to my veteran brothers and sisters, welcome home. And to all of you folks out in other countries like Tasmania and Brazil, Scotland, it's so great to hear from you and know that you're listening in. And good morning, America. What a pleasure to be here. What a terrific celebration for our country. And I don't know if I was talking to Peter Fletcher earlier, and I don't know of any other country that he'll be able to talk about that does celebrate like we do. And I read an interesting story about how it all began. Right now, it's the celebration of our birthday, of our nation's birthday, and we're going to celebrate. I have to believe that is the most recognized national anthem in the world. Would you agree with me, Peter Fletcher?
I certainly would, and it tells a remarkable story about a matchless country.
Indeed it does. This morning, this is so much fun. We have Peter Fletcher as a guest. And I guess the best story I have for telling of Peter Fletcher is when he was the Michigan State Highway Commissioner. And every year the highway commissioner is responsible for the new highway maps. And if anybody's ever noticed on a highway map, they always kind of bleed over into the next state to find, so you know where you're starting from and the points of reference. And the year that he was highway commissioner, the part that showed the northern part of Ohio, Peter noticed that two towns were left out of all previous maps. And being a University of Michigan graduate, he decided that needed to be corrected, and Ohio gained two new towns, one named Go Blue and the other one named Beat OSU. Peter Fletcher, welcome to Veterans Radio with all of your humor.
Thank you so much. I must confess that my map caper has become a rather mark of Cain, and that happened 30 years ago and to this day. Not a month goes by, but something doesn't come up about that map maneuver. And I've always felt that anyone south of Monroe would understand that Ohio is nothing but another four-letter word and a cultural wasteland. So, of course, they needed to have those emendations that were very appropriate.
And for our listeners in Ohio, you can get the last word in just after 10 o'clock.
Yes, of course.
And our apologies. Peter,
we have nothing to apologize for. After all, they stole Toledo from us in the Toledo War, and I still haven't forgiven them.
Well, we got the Upper Peninsula.
No, the western half of the Upper Peninsula.
Oh, yes.
No, I say we came out ahead, but we deserve to.
Right. Yeah, and Toledo, you could have been part of Michigan.
Had it not been for that. Poor souls.
Today we're talking about the birth of our nation and the events leading up to it, but there's one little trivia item that I get the greatest kick out of. What did King George write in his diary on July 4th, 1776?
poor King George III. They didn't call him Mad King George III for nothing. Mad psychologically and mad mentally, but nothing of importance happened today. But that, of course, was the day long before telephones, telegraphs, internet, or anything. Otherwise, he never would have written that.
How ironic. Nothing of importance happened today, July 4th, 1776.
Oh, my. No, 234 years ago, a truly remarkable event took place with the signing of and the publication of and the reading of our Declaration of Independence. And it remains one of the high water marks in the use of the English language in defining what government should be about, what government must be about, and why people have freedom and independence unlike any place else in the world. Because Thomas Jefferson really put together a remarkable combination of words, defined it, proclaimed it. To this day, people around the world turn to that document for inspiration, for understanding, for clarity. What is self-government about? Because self-government is not for the faint of heart. Self-government is a very important responsibility. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that too many Americans take it for granted because we have such a vastly superior system to any place else, and our history has confirmed it. We had to go through a terrible civil war in order to confirm it. We, of course, fought World War II to preserve it, and we continue to this day. I only hope that the students in our schools are being taught this heritage and how it must be preserved, it must be enhanced, and it must be passed on to future generations.
And I'm so concerned that kids are not being taught the positive things about our country today and about the history.
Well, I don't even insist that they be taught only the positive. Teach the positive, teach the negative, teach everything. And the important thing is understand why this country is so truly unusual, unique, and we use the phrase God bless America. We really should say God continue to bless America, because God has blessed us from the very founding. We had remarkable leaders all through the history at the right time. You look at the founding persons of this country and the remarkable history that they were able to. George Washington, this patrician, this person who really didn't have any particular reason. He was successful. He had a very handsome home at Mount Vernon, which I hope everyone has had an opportunity to visit. And but the whole idea, he got thoroughly fed up with the British interfering with our freedoms, and he was determined to do something about it. And then he had people such as John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and, of course, that master words craftsman in Thomas Paine. These are the times that try men's souls, the summer soldier and the sunshine patriot. But the other phrase I thoroughly enjoy is that he then said, the palaces of kings are built on the ruins of the bowers of paradise. So Thomas Paine set the tone for rejecting the idea that there should be a monarchy, rejecting the idea that there should be any form of dictatorship. The people themselves must select their leaders, and then the leaders must return periodically to be either confirmed or dismissed, depending on whether or not they are serving the public good.
You know, we listen to the different Jefferson, and mainly Jefferson, I believe. Sometimes, you know, Ben Franklin, but there were so many. Before we get into that, I want to bring to the attention of our viewers that normally you can go to veteransradio.net and see the simultaneous webcast while you're listening to the program. What we have to do today is, because of a technical problem, go to ustream.tv. Go to that website and then do a search on Veterans Radio, and up it will pop, and you'll see all sorts of things on there that I've never seen before. I'm going to watch it on Ustream from now on. And that would be Ustream, the letter Ustream.tv, and then do a search for Veterans Radio. We'll be showing things such as the photographs of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Martha Washington, our Declaration of Independence. Peter, how is it that the people were so well-spoken back then compared to today?
Well, of course, they didn't have the clutter of television and movies and these other things that have turned us into such slothful people intellectually that they had to communicate with the written word. English is a very good language to use to communicate. And the English of those days was precise, and yes, we think of it as a little dated today. We read but the majesty of Jefferson's words in the Declaration will remain forever. I mean, no matter what else happens to the use of the English language, no matter how slovenly we may become, the dignity of it, the clarity of it, he was very, very good at using precision, using direct, nothing obscure. Nothing obscure about what he was communicating. And he organized it in such a way. He set out at the beginning of the Declaration, he sets out why it is that we're doing this and our certain inherent rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then he uses a very interesting phrase that has been one of my favorites that I would like to quote very quickly. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. In other words, he was explaining, well, we sort of get into a rut, we get into habits of government, and even though it may not be serving our best interests, we put up with it. But that we had done that long enough as Americans, and therefore it was time to throw off the shackles of the most powerful empire in the world at that time. And here are these upstarts in 13 colonies, 3,000 miles away from England, and they decide it is time to stop this nonsense. It is time to establish and create a free and independent nation with all of the powers inherent in that freedom. And that's precisely what happened on July the 4th, 1776. And it now echoes throughout the ages and certainly is a very, very valid and remarkable and valid reason for us to celebrate every July the 4th.
I'll try to find it because I printed it out. A description of what took place on July the 4th, 1777, in the town of Philadelphia. Nobody had ever even talked about celebrating. It was a last-minute thing, but a few people thought that they would celebrate on July the 2nd and then July the 3rd, and nothing happened. And spontaneously, on July the 4th, 1776, celebration just started in a small way and built and built and built and was... Oh, just magnificent. I'll find that, and I think it was John Adams who described it in a letter to his daughter. I could be mistaken about who it was, but what we've celebrated every year since then. Does any other country do that?
Very seldom. For example, Gary, I've often heard visitors to our country comment on the phenomenon that our flag is so displayed by not only on government buildings, public buildings, but private citizens display the flag. The flag means so much more than just a piece of cloth. It stands for the entire concept, the tradition, the heritage. Every soldier who has ever served, every person who has ever been elected to a public office, every person who has even served in a nonprofit, whether it's his church or his synagogue or his temple or whatever it happens to be, Alexis de Tocqueville commented on the phenomenon that Americans, unlike any other group of people in the world, help each other. They help their neighbors. They respond to challenges. They respond to needs of these the less fortunate, the more challenged, and it is a noble characteristic. But we have been a great melting pot. Our country is made up of so many different nationalities and traditions and heritages, and we've blended them together in this remarkable tapestry of human goodness. And therefore, we need to celebrate. We also need to keep looking and seeing what can we do to improve, what can we do to enhance it, what can we do to move forward, keep on progressing.
And what are some of the events leading up to the Declaration of Independence? I mean, not the Tea Party or so on, but the personalities. How did this discussion begin?
One of the interesting little-known facts is that there was one member of the British Parliament who supported American independence, and his name was John Wilkes. And that's where John Wilkes Booth, the assassin, got his name, from this Englishman who really believed that America deserved its independence.
The assassin of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes,
later,
exactly.
Right?
And but you had people such as Patrick Henry, people, let's Thrasonical Gasconading, give me liberty or give me death, but that's exactly what he meant. And these dramatic words, and the pamphleteers, the people who wrote about it, the people who went to various meetings, went to various gatherings, and kept emphasizing, we have got to throw off the shackles, we have got to assume our own liberties. By the way, speaking of Paul Revere, his famous riot on April 18th, 75, was generated by the issuance of an order from General Thomas Gage that the British were going to march towards Lexington and Concord, and that was going to provoke the shot heard round the world and that sort of thing. And the original order issued by General Gage is now in the possession of the Clements Library on the campus of the University of Michigan. And on very special occasions, they can still display that. And Regent Clements, many years ago, gathered the largest collection of British documents and papers relating to the American Revolution extant and quietly acquired them, and they are in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, I was aware of that because our good friend, Al, oh my Lord, just email with him all the time. Why am I drawing a blank? He was listening to us from Tasmania right now. Almost midnight there. Maybe it is midnight there. We met him because he came to Ann Arbor to do some research on one of his ancestors who was a general in the British Army, and came to the Clements Library.
Sure, certainly.
And he's a Vietnam veteran, wanted to know if there was a memorial here he could lay a wreath at, and so there we met him. And just became very, very close friends with he and his wife. I apologize for Woods. Why am I drawing a blank on my good friend's name?
Well, because you have a mind that has such an inventory of remarkable experiences. Come on, Gary, give yourself a little credit.
Okay.
I also want to comment especially that we talk about the founding fathers. We really should be talking about the founding patriots, that there were men and women, both who were very active. Martha Washington, for example, she advised General Washington and then President Washington on get rid of the trappings of the monarchy, get rid of what smacks of the English influence. We want to represent the people. We want to reflect. We want to demonstrate that we are creating a new order. And, of course, that's part of the motto. And then, of course, the interesting thing in the Declaration of Independence, they do not capitalize the word united when they refer to the United States, because the states were still so important. But by the time we come to our Civil War, by the time we move on, the United States of America becomes a singular phrase, and all the words are capitalized, because we have become one nation, as our Pledge to the Flag says and reminds us every time we recite it. And therefore, we also should recognize that Abigail Adams was a very, very important counselor to her husband John in explaining, well, these are the things we should be thinking about getting accomplished.
Give
these
us an example.
Projects. For example, John was debating, well, now, just how much should I follow in the footsteps of President Washington? President Washington had to set a number of examples and precedents because he was the first one. well, should John Adams depart from that? And Abigail said, no, look at them, pick and choose. Now, there may be a few minor things you want to change as far as maybe social customs, something like that, the way you dress. John was kind of a rumpled gentleman, and so she would have to lecture him on that once in a while, whereas, of course, George Washington was rather... And George Washington was a little more precise in the way he presented himself. But then you have, of course, Dolly Madison really set the example of the use of the executive residence to, in effect, politic. She would invite guests from Congress. She would invite members of Congress. She would invite people from government, from business, so on. And they would have parties. They would have gatherings. But then they could talk some politics. They could do some informal negotiating and get things resolved. And Dolly is the one who really introduced that idea on how to get things done. Even though you may be on opposite sides of an issue, you could debate, negotiate, and then come up with some reasonable compromise.
And they were in the White House in the War of 1812.
Yes, yes.
And I found some fascinating quotes by her, but the British, as we most of us know, or everybody should know, burnt down the White House. My grandmother would use a word, but I don't know if I can say it on air. It's not an American swear word. I'm afraid it's a Scottish swear word. But I found some quotes by Dolly Madison leading up to, as the British were advancing towards the White House, to her sister. And now, dear sister, I must leave this house, or the retreating army will make me a prisoner in it by filling up the road I am directed to take. So you can just picture by the sentence,
oh, yes,
what was going on there. Now, here are two things that struck me. At this late hour, a wagon has been procured, and I have had it filled with plate and the most valuable portable articles belonging to the house, the White House. And the next one, I am accordingly ready. I have pressed as many cabinet papers into trunks as to fill one carriage. Our private property must be sacrificed, as it is impossible to procure wagons for its transportation. First came the possessions of the nation, of the house, the president's house, and next came the cabinet papers that she preserved and abandoned all of their private property behind to be burnt, which they obviously knew was going to be coming.
Oh, yes.
We have 1 minute left in this segment.
Very quickly, I'd like to refer to another woman. Her name was Mary McCauley, but all of you will recognize her name as Molly Pitcher. And the Pitcher referred to the fact she was carrying water to the troops as they were busy fighting the Battle of Monmouth, June the 25th, 1778. And then, when her husband was killed on his cannon firing, she took over immediately and kept on firing the cannon. And here was another one of these women that we don't often give enough credit to as far as making certain that the revolution succeeded.
The personal sacrifice, and if you can imagine, now just picture it, you hear that and you say, oh, wow. But just picture, put yourself in that position, the noise and the smoke and the enemy not that far away because the guns didn't have that much range.
Of course.
And her husband laying dead, and it would have to have been brutal, and she picks up his place. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We're talking to Peter Fletcher about the birth of our nation. We'll be back right after this.
Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Platoon Sergeant Finnis McCleary continued his assault on the North Vietnamese position, although severely wounded. Details after this.
College isn't cheap. In fact, it can be downright expensive. But the Air Force has a way for you to get that college education. If you attend classes while on active duty, we'll pay up to 100% of your tuition. And you could have more than $35,000 for school waiting for you through the GI Bill. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on to airforce.com. This message brought to you by the U.S. Air Force and this station.
A combined force was assigned the mission of assaulting a reinforced company of well-entrenched North Vietnamese Army regulars. As McCleary led his men up the hill and across an open area to close with the enemy, his platoon and other friendly elements were pinned down by heavy fire coming from the fortified enemy positions. Realizing the severe damage that the enemy could inflict on the combined force, McCleary rose from his sheltered position and began a one-man assault on the bunker complex. He moved across 60 meters of open ground as bullets struck all around him and rockets and grenades literally exploded at his feet. As he came within 30 meters of the key enemy bunker, McCleary began firing furiously from the hip and throwing hand grenades. At this point in his assault, shrapnel painfully wounded him, but with complete disregard for his wounds, he continued his advance on the key bunker and killed all of its occupants. Having successfully and single-handedly breaching the enemy perimeter, he climbed to the top of the bunker he had just captured and, in full view of the enemy, shouted encouragement to his men to follow his assault. As the friendly forces moved forward, McCleary began a lateral assault on the enemy bunker line. He continued to expose himself to the intense enemy fire as he moved from bunker to bunker, destroying each in turn. He was wounded a second time by shrapnel as he destroyed and routed the enemy from the hill. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Safe and hardworking over-the-road truck drivers deserve modern and well-maintained equipment they can count on. Conway Truckload has purchased over 500 new Kenworth T680s with twin-screw axle drives, automated manual transmission, and other features that improve handling and comfort. Take a virtual tour of the equipment on truetoblue.com/equipment. Speak to a recruiter and apply to drive for Conway Truckload by calling 866-WORK-FOR-US. That's 866, the word work, the number 4, and the U-S.
You're listening to a special encore performance of Veterans Radio. This program first aired on July 3rd, 2010. So return with us now to Gary Lilly and his guest, Peter Fletcher.
And we're coming back with the Stars and Stripes Forever. But before, you have a little story to tell about that. Before you do, Al and Barbara Woods down in Tasmania. How great to know that you're listening. My gosh, don't feel bad. I drew a blank on your name. I do that with everybody. Isn't that right, Joe? Peter, you have a story about
the
that?
Stars and Stripes Forever, of course, John Philip Sousa. Now, Vienna has the waltz king, Johann Strauss, but we have the march king. And John Philip Sousa was the man who, in the spring following the game in Chicago, that inspired Louis L. Bell to write the famous, unmatched fight song for the University of Michigan, The Victors. And the following spring, in Ann Arbor, John Philip Sousa performed the first public presentation of that and proclaimed this is the finest of all college march songs and one of the five greatest marches of all time. Now, that's pretty hard to top.
Yes, yes, it is. Let's get back to the pre-Revolutionary War.
Let's talk about, I want to give a couple of women's names that I don't think too many people recognize, but when I give the third of this trio, then you'll understand. Cornelia Bridges and Rebecca Young. Three women from Pennsylvania were approached by President Washington and asked to prepare a flag. And, of course, the third was Betsy Ross. And the president said, I want this flag to be an American emblem. I don't want it to have anything that even remotely resembles anything English. And therefore, because early flags had included the Union Jack, and that, of course, is very British. And he said, no, 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 no. And he said, why don't we use stars? Why do we have stars? We are a new constellation. And so they developed the design of the flag, and today we have the same basics. The 13 stripes, referring, of course, to commemorating and honoring the 13 original colonies. And why do we continue to honor that? Because the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, the people who fought in the American Revolution, they all realized they were putting their lives on the line. 58 men signed the Declaration of Independence from the 13 colonies. Every one of those men knew that they were putting their life right on the line.
They were signing their own death sentence.
Oh, exactly.
Things went wrong.
They could have been arrested. They could have been hanged for treason. But they were willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And how many times has this country been served by patriots who are willing to give greater love hath no man than give his life for another? And we have had so many of those fantastic examples, whether it was in the American Revolution, whether it was in any of the succeeding wars, whatever it happens to have been. And this country has to be something truly unusual, sui generis, for people to be willing to make that type of sacrifice. And therefore, there is no way we can possibly honor our veterans sufficiently, honor our forebears sufficiently. That's why we must continue to do it. We must continue to teach and honor these traditions.
We must celebrate. Bob, would you pull up the original Declaration of Independence, please, the one with the signatures on it? Because John Hancock's name is so predominant on there. Why?
You remember why?
I was about to ask you why.
Well,
why
here's
is
what happened.
Signature so
John
big?
Hancock stepped. He stepped up there and he signed his name in these huge letters. You can't miss it. And he said, "Quote: I want King George to be able to read my signature without his spectacles." It was really in your face. It was
defiant.
Absolutely,
right.
Because he was. No, these people were so brave and not intimidated, because in some respects the British vastly underestimated the true commitment these founding persons had. They didn't understand the depth of the feeling, and how very appropriate that when Earl Lord Cornwallis finally surrendered at Yorktown, the band played, the world turned upside down. And that's exactly what was happening, because here was this ragtag mob beating the world's most powerful empire and beating him but good. I had fun a few years ago. There was a store in downtown Ypsilanti that sold merchandise from the United Kingdom. So they had a Union Jack hanging outside. No American flag, but just a Union Jack. So I couldn't resist. One day I stuck my head in the door. "Word has just been received. Earl Lord Cornwallis has surrendered at Yorktown. It's time to change the flag." And disappeared. And guess what? The flag disappeared.
Oh,
they realized this is the United States of America, and it is the American flag that we want displayed, and we want it displayed prominently.
You have too much fun.
Now, speaking of that, the Star Spangled Banner and the Stars and Stripes Forever and so on, these are, of course, later songs. The song that they would have heard back in Washington's day was, of course, Yankee Doodle. And I always enjoyed the observation made by another truly great American, one of the persons I very much respect, and that's Ulysses Grant. Ulysses Grant really saved the Union, was a man of intense bravery, but also very magnanimous. What he did at Appomattox, as far as welcoming them back, they are our brothers.
Right.
We are too. The war is over. We're not going to continue to fight the war that is over. And he was a remarkable person, but he often said, "I only know two pieces of music. One of them is Yankee Doodle, the other is not." So he was much more of a soldier's soldier rather than a musician.
Who became president later on.
Exactly.
But, he is.
And he had that same magnanimous spirit while he was president. And in fact, General Lee visited him twice in the White House.
Really?
They really became, and one time General Lee, he had become president of Washington Lee University, and there in the Washington area, and one time someone made a very disparaging remark to General Lee about President Grant, and Lee stopped him right there. He said, "I will not hear one word of criticism of President Grant, and if you insist on saying that, one of us will not be on this campus." He knew what Grant had done for him and what it had done for the South, to restore the Union, to bring people back together.
Which made him very unpopular.
Oh, of course. But it was still, it was the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
And, you know, a man from Michigan who became president followed that same tradition.
Yes.
And that was Gerald Ford, when he pardoned Richard Nixon, and he was vilified, and even his most violent critics years later said he did the right thing. You had to move beyond it.
Isn't it interesting? President Mandela did that and was very unpopular for a while.
Yes. I mean,
right. But in the end, doing the right thing is always the right thing to do. And
it usually comes out. It usually comes out sooner or later. Unfortunately, too many times, the person who has done the right thing may not live long enough to receive the appropriate accolades and encomiums and so on as a result.
Just struck me about when that popped into my mind about Mandela, the same people that talk about how great he was for doing that are often the ones that criticize Ford for
pardoning Nixon.
Pardoning Nixon.
Right,
thank
exactly,
you. Those big
exactly.
words always told me. Everybody knows that.
Gary, I have been very, very fortunate. Here I am, a simple country boy from Ypsilanti, Michigan. I have been fortunate enough to meet 9 different presidents of the United States and every governor of the state of Michigan who has served during my lifetime. And at Gerry Ford, I got to know him very well. And the higher up he got on the political ladder, the more laid back he was. He was so unaffected by the fuss and feathers. And we made a terrible mistake in firing him as president because the man had all the decency, the instincts, everything that you want in a president of the United States. But those are the things we have to look back and learn from. We must learn from this.
Right. And we had that with George Washington.
Yes.
Tell us the story about what happened when he decided that he would no longer be president, King George.
First of all, Washington established the tradition, 2 terms. That was it. George Washington was the most powerful person in the country when he completed his 2nd term as president. He could have been president for life. He was honored and venerated and virtually worshipped. He was at the top of his, he was at the absolute pinnacle as far as public approbation, public worship. He was worshipped. And therefore, he announced he would not be seeking another term, and that he said that he wanted us to now raise a standard to which the wise and the just may repair. And personal power, personal veneration, personal accolades, no. He wanted to return to Mount Vernon, be a country gentleman, a farmer, and which is precisely what he did. When King George III, here had been this bitter enemy and everything, thought that Washington was a traitor and everything else, but when King George III of England heard that Washington was voluntarily giving up all this power and returning to the life of a private citizen, he said, if that is true, George Washington is the greatest person in the world. Because he recognized no one with that sort of power had ever voluntarily given it up before he was either compelled to or died. And it was a very impressive comment. George III was not the most stable person, not the wisest, but he certainly understood what a truly remarkable precedent Washington set.
And he had, and going back to how revered he was, I came across a letter when the Constitution was presented to him. He was addressed as George Washington, President, His Excellency, the President of Congress. And you're listening to Veterans Radio, coming to you from WDEO, Ann Arbor, Michigan, on the Ave Maria Radio Network. And we're talking to Peter Fletcher about the birth of our nation. There's so many fascinating stories. And we'll be right back right after this message. Yankee Doodle Dandy, as you just said, fife and drum, very authentic.
Exactly.
Right. We're coming to you from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the city just to our east is Ypsilanti, Michigan, which you have made famous.
Well,
or was it Ypsilanti made you famous?
Ann Arbor is one of the modest suburbs of Ypsilanti, of course, because Ypsilanti is a year older than Ann Arbor, so, of course, filled with much more intellectual prowess, many, many remarkable things. However, Ypsilanti has a connection with Martha Washington, and thereby hangs a tale. Back after World War II, the Willow Run bomber plant had been built very quickly by Henry Ford and produced 8,800 B-24 bombers that made a big difference
Indeed. In
winning that war in the European theater. And, in fact, our former governor, longest-serving governor, William G. Milliken, served as a gunner on a B-24 bomber and was shot down not once but twice. And the first time he was shot down, he automatically qualified to come home. He said, "I'm not going home. The war isn't over." These are the sorts of people who never talk about it. The genuine heroes in all of our wars never talk about it. It's a remarkable characteristic of the. That's how you know a real hero.
Right.
The ones who are not the heroes are the ones who make up all these stories that have much more fiction than they have fact. But what happened is right after the war, here's this big plant, and all of a sudden Henry Kaiser, who had built the ships during the war and so on, decided that he wanted to go in the automobile business because he hadn't been able to build automobiles during World War II. And so he had the Kaiser Fraser plant. He took over the old bomber plant and had Kaiser Fraser, and he built Kaiser Automobiles and Fraser Automobiles. Well, Joseph Fraser's wife was the great-great-great-grandniece of Martha Washington. And so I love telling people when they go over the history of Ypsilanti and say, well, there was the Kaiser Fraser plant, and then tell them the story of Joseph Fraser's wife.
And do you have any little stories like that for Naples, Florida, and for New Orleans?
Wait a minute. Naples, I'll have to confess, my dad was a native of Ypsilanti, also very devoted to Ypsilanti, but he happened to love going to Naples in the wintertime.
And you people out in Los Angeles, California, there's a lot of stories about you too.
We don't
have time for them. I came across a letter of John Adams to his daughter, Abigail Adams, dated July 5th, 1777. And it's funny because nobody thought about celebrating. And he said, "Yesterday, being the anniversary of American independence, was celebrated here with a festivity and ceremony becoming the occasion. I am too old to delight in pretty descriptions if I had the talent for them. Otherwise, a picture might be drawn which would please the fancy of a Whig, at least." He goes on, "The thought of taking notice of this day was not conceived until the 2nd of this month, and it was not mentioned until the 3rd. It was too late to have a sermon, as everyone wished, so this must be deferred another year. Congress determined to adjourn over that day and to dine together. The general officers and others in town were invited after the President, Council, and Board of War of this state." And he goes on to talk about how things spontaneously happened and grew and grew and grew. In the morning, the Delaware frigate, the name Delaware, had several large galleys and other Continental armed vessels. The Pennsylvania ship and row galleys and guard boats were all hauled off in the river, and several of them beautifully dressed in the colors of all nations displayed about noon the masts, yards, and riggings. And then he goes on to talk about how the President and several gentlemen of the Marine Committee, soon after which we were saluted with a discharge of 13 guns. They visited the Delaware by going on board. And it goes on and on. And then at the very end, I found this really, really interesting. Let me see if I can find the right spot. And at 3, we went to dinner. He's talking about after dinner, the toasts and all that, and how the people, the soldiers marched into Congress. And then he says, the people went somewhere, but I did not follow them. In the evening, I was walking about the streets for a little fresh air and exercise, and was surprised to find the whole city lighting up their candles at the windows. I walked most of the evening, and I think it was the most splendid illumination I ever saw. A few surly houses were dark, but the lights were very universal. Considering the lateness of the design and the suddenness of the execution, I was amazed at the universal joy and alacrity that was discovered and at the brilliancy and splendor of every part of this joyful exhibition. And isn't that a wonderful description of the very first?
Now, a little Trivial Pursuit. Tomorrow evening, July the 4th, there's going to be a huge fireworks display at the Straits of Mackinac. The Grand Hotel has one. They fire fireworks off from the right. Mackinac Bridge. They fire them off from Mackinac City. You can see them as far away as Sheboygan. Great right. show. Why in the world is that especially appropriate? Oh. What does Mackinac have to do with the American Revolution?
Well, it was British fort.
Exactly. It is the only building still left, the fort that's still there on Mackinac Island, the only building left from the time of the American Revolution.
Really?
Yes. And therefore, that's why it's so appropriate. And they have reenactments there.
Oh,
they
yeah.
show the, they have the British flags there displayed along with the American, of course, obviously. And then Mackinac was also used as a POW camp during the Civil War. And,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yep. And the other thing that very few people remember, speaking of American history and military history, that George Gordon Meade, the successful general at Gettysburg, was stationed at Mackinac for 2 or 3 years prior to the Civil War. So he served there for a while. And there's a little marker and everything that commemorates that as well. So even though Michigan was not even the Federal Union, wasn't even part of the country technically, we still have connections with the American Revolution, which we're talking about. The other thing I wanted to mention is that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were not very friendly with each other politically at the beginning. They had their differences. Jefferson was more in the states' rights, and we mustn't let the central government be too powerful, and so on and so forth. And so they argued quite vigorously, and Washington had to play peacemaker on a number of occasions. What happened was, of course, Thomas Jefferson then becomes the third president, sort of has this opposition point of view, and one of the very first things he does completely departs from his political tradition, and he makes the Louisiana Purchase, and which, of course, was a fantastic step forward for our country. But the other thing that happened is that for some unknown reason lost in the midst of history, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson began a very spirited and friendly and constructive correspondence with each other about government and the philosophy of government and self-government and what our country should be doing and this and this. It went on for many years, and it only ceased on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration on July the 4th, 1826, and both of those gentlemen died on that day. Mm-hmm. Now, talk about coincidence. Oh, my goodness. I love posing those to atheists and asking, now, how do you explain that? how do these coincidences happen?
And this country had its founding on faith. You know, the Thomas Jefferson, there's a dispute about what he really meant when he said he didn't say separation of church and state. What was the term that he used?
He had, good point, Gary, because the confusion that has come up is our concept of separating church and state, having what it involved is we were not going to have a state religion as the British do. We were going to permit religious freedom, and therefore they kept talking about religious freedom, so that you were free to worship in any way you felt comfortable, as any way that matched your beliefs. And that government was not going to mandate anything relating to that. And, of course, I think it's been one of the great contributions we've made. The other great contribution, of course, was the whole idea of federalism, that there were three branches of government. Now, the nice question that I like to ask government students, what is the difference between the separation of powers and the division of powers? And the answer is the separation of powers is the three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial. The division of powers is the division between the federal government and the state government. And that, again, was a unique contribution that to our forebears, our founding persons, made in organizing the government way back at the beginning.
What an almost perfect constitution and concept of government that this country has. And we're slipping away from it, I think, and bit by bit, we have 40 seconds left. So
why do you think that our Constitution, written way back, adopted in 1787, has only been amended 27 times because it was a true masterpiece in
Indeed.
How to construct a free and successful and perpetual government.
And with that, Peter, thank you so much for being on Veterans
Radio.
Well,
thank you for enduring my soporific pontificating.
Oh, always, always enjoyable. And until then, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
Thank you for listening to this special encore performance of Veterans Radio. This program was first heard on July 3rd, 2010, with our late partner Gary Lilly and his guest Peter Fletcher. We hope you enjoyed the program. We're running a little short, so we are going to be playing some patriotic music to fill out the hour. Thanks again, and don't forget to tune in to Veterans Radio next week, right here on WHAM 1600.